This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. Door-to-door salesman, taxi driver, telemarketer, private eye, hotel night manager, chauffeur. Those were just some of the jobs Dan Fonte held before becoming a writer. And he had many rough years before he even began to think of himself as a writer. Years as a drunk. Years he describes as train wrecks with off-the-wall, winner-take-all relationships. Fonte is the son of writer John Fonte, best known for his 1939 novel Ask the Dust, a novel set in L.A. during the Depression. That book was rescued from obscurity when Charles Bukowski discovered it, helped get it republished in 1980, and wrote an introduction in which he described John Fonte as his god. John died in 1983. Now Dan Fonte, his son, is in his 60s, sober, with several novels of his own. They revolve around his alter ego Bruno Dante, a character who has held many of the jobs his creator Dan Fonte held, but who has not yet achieved his sobriety. Two of Dan Fonte's earlier Bruno Dante novels have just been republished, Mooch from 2000 and Spitting Off Tall Buildings from 2001. In Fonte's latest novel, 86th, Bruno has left his telemarketing job to work for a limo service while trying to deal with his demons. Terry spoke with Dan Fonte last year when 86th was published.
Dan Fonte, welcome to Fresh Air. I'd like to start with a short reading from the second chapter of your novel, 86th.
I have no idea why I am crazy and angry and edged out most of the time, and why alcohol and painkiller pills and Xanax-type stuff are the only things that help to keep me remotely calm. I have no idea why I experience my life as pointless and screwed up. And I know that most people don't pour a cup of bourbon into their milk and oatmeal in the morning. That's just how it is.
Well, thank you for reading that. You know, I'm thinking, you've been sober for years now, right?
I've been sober. I'll be sober 23 years in December.
Congratulations. So it must be pretty weird to be sober after a long time and then immerse yourself in writing about somebody who's not, to always be going back to that place.
It's an interesting question, yeah.
How does it feel to always go back to the place of needing alcohol and needing pills and taking too much of both and getting really sick and getting into constant trouble?
Well, Kafka said a good novel should be like a blow to the head. And that's, you know, there's something I'm trying to say about the humanity of this character. And it's not yet been exhausted. So I go there and I can feel him because that's who I used to be.
In your novel, the character starts writing as a result of rehab. In rehab, he has to fill out a questionnaire, and the questionnaire has questions like, when you look back on your life, what memories are still uncomfortable and painful? What incidents make you feel dirty? And what about yourself do you experience as inadequate? Did you have to answer questions like that in rehab, and that inspire you to sit down and start writing? Yeah.
No, it inspired me to hate 12-step programs. No, I stumbled on a guy who had many years of sobriety and recovery, and he gave me this format of writing what's called an inventory in the 12 steps, a fourth step. And his form of inventory was to write the story of my life an hour a day for 12 consecutive days at exactly the same time every morning, and not to look back, and when I was done, to call him and read it to him. And so I called him, and I said, Ken, I want to read this fourth step to you. And he said, well, how long are you sober, kid? And I said, well, I'm sober, a year this time, but I've been sober 3 out of the 5 years, you know. And he said, long pause on the other end of the phone. He said, you know, that's good in baseball. Call somebody else. And then he hung up. But what had happened to me, Terry, from that, and I didn't know it. It's interesting. I'm working on a memoir now about myself and my father, and I'm just at this part of the memoir. What happened from that? I had 31 typewritten pages, single-spaced, and it occurred to me a couple of years later that I couldn't write a novel, but I might be able to write a page a day from that exercise. And, you know, I'm working on my 10th book right now. So I don't write books. I write pages.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dan Fonte, and his new novel is called 86th. How would you describe your father's writing and the impact, if any, it had on you as a writer in terms of, like, the themes that he would write about, the stories that he would write about?
Well, it had an enormous impact stylistically, but my father was a victim of the quote, modern, unquote, literary canon. So I'm a postmodern writer. My father could not say the things that I say. And toward the end of his life, when he could, in the late 70s, when he was dictating his last book to my mother, he was blind. He could have been more graphic, and he wasn't. So he wrote primarily about his family and about his own experience with his family and about his dog. So our themes are different, I think, except for Ask the Dust. I mean, there's a similarity in Ask the Dust to my work. But I think he was trapped in a literary canon of 1931, you know.
Whereas you're writing very graphically about drugs and sex and not so much. I mean, I don't want to give the wrong idea. It's not pornographic or anything. But
no, it's true.
Okay. Right. But, I mean, you're writing very much from someone who's really made a mess of his life.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I don't think, you know, my dad became a successful Hollywood writer when he was quite young, 22, 23, and for the rest of his life was seduced back into screenwriting rather than do what his sensibility. He was born to be a novelist. He was born to be a storyteller. But, you know, he just couldn't refuse $500,000 a year, you know, or the equivalent of that.
That's what he was getting for being a script doctor?
Oh, God. His first paycheck, the guy walked in. Now, we're talking about 1932 or 33. And the man walked in and handed him a check for $250, which was the equivalent of maybe $3,000 or $4,000 for a week's work today. And he got up and went back. He opened his pay envelope and walked back to the guy and said, "You made a mistake. You put a zero on the end of the 25."
Wow.
So he couldn't believe. So 1932, if you made $250 for a short story and you did it every 6 months, you could live on that. My father was making that every week in the movie business.
So you went from a pretty prosperous home to basically living in the gutter for a while.
Well, although, yes, I mean, I grew up in Malibu. But Malibu wasn't Malibu and when I grew up there. It was, you know, a beach town. Now it's got the, you know, those $70,000 a month recovery resorts and palazzos overlooking the Pacific Ocean. It was just a big windswept plateau when I lived there. But to call us prosperous. We were prosperous when he was working, you know, I guess.
Now, you've held many jobs during the period when
yes.
you were drunk and using pills and other drugs. And one of those jobs was chauffeur. And yes. The character in your new novel, 86th, is a chauffeur in L.A. And I'd like you to read a paragraph in which your character describes what that's like.
Okay. Working in the limo business in L.A. is a bizarre way to make a buck, like licking up dog poop for God. The clientele for Daveco in Los Angeles was mostly made up of night freaks and zombies, rich cranked-out movie producers, spoiled rock star punks, gangster rappers with their black Glocks tucked into their belts of their pants, alky ex-actors with too many DUIs, and a gazillion wannabe high rollers, human beings who exhibit the most unpleasant personality characteristics common to L.A., too much ego and way too much money.
So is that your experience of what it was like to be a limo driver?
Oh, yeah. No, I drove I drove Rod Stewart and Mick Jagger and Ringo Starr. I drove Elton John. I drove John Lennon when he was alive.
Gee.
We had quite a clientele in those days.
So when you were driving for all these rock stars, were you sober then? Not that they were necessarily sober, but they probably want their driver to be sober.
Yeah, I knew early on when I was driving a cab in the 60s, early 70s, that I couldn't drink and drive. I knew it because my inclination is once I take a drink, I don't stop. I have to keep going. So I just wouldn't do it while I worked. Now, that held true until I got to California years later and owned the joint and with a partner, and then all bets were off. Then I started having, I started getting arrested more and had some problems.
Now, you've written about all the odd jobs that you've had over the years before you became a professional writer. Most of my adult life had been spent being one kind of pitch man or another. I've always found myself gravitating toward the jive and shuck, selling. This is strange to say because by nature I don't like people and I'm a loner. So what kinds of things did you sell over the years?
Oh, God. My best gig I was a telemarketer. I sold when I lost the limo business and hit bottom and was homeless there for a while. I bumped into a guy who was a recovering heroin addict, and he had a phone room. And this was in the early 80s, and I began to sell computer supplies at the beginning of the blossoming of the computer supply industry. And I made, I think my best month, I was averaging about 25 grand a month.
Wow.
And that was in the, the middle 80s, And then I just, had a house at the beach and a sports car and a aerobics teacher girlfriend. They all got relocated, Terry.
What do you mean?
When I took that first drink, things changed.
Oh, I got it.
And that was the end of my career. But I had about a 3-4 year run in that industry where I did very well. And then, but that bottoming out, what happened was, it's very interesting. I couldn't lie to people anymore. I got sober. I just couldn't lie to people anymore on the phone. Just couldn't do it. So, I wound up homeless again living in the back bedroom of my mother's house with her giving me $50 a week for gas for her 7-cylinder Chrysler New Yorker that was 10 years old. And I just started walking to meetings and I didn't know what to do, so I started to write. That's when I started to write.
I'm wondering if you have any passages from your father's work that you could quote for us that stand out in your mind and would give our listeners a sense of his writing.
I have something. I brought Ask the Dust with me. And this is this wonderful quote from the first two or three pages of John Fante's Ask the Dust. Los Angeles, come to me the way I come to you, my feet over your streets. You pretty town, I loved you so much. You sad flower in the sand, you pretty town.
Obviously, it's very emotional for you to read that. From reading your own writing, the sense I get is that you and your father were pretty alienated from each other when you were young, and it was only later in life that you really got to got to know each other well?
No. I think got to accept one another, probably. We started out tolerating each other, disliking each other and tolerating each other. And then toward the end of his life, when I started to write, I once wrote a poem for a guy in upstate New York to dedicate his home. This guy was a very wealthy, I was a limo driver at the time in New York City, and very wealthy designer. And he took this 200-year-old farmhouse and completely redid it, gutted it and completely redid it. And so I wrote a poem to dedicate the house. And the guy went to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and he had it, a calligrapher, inscribe it on parchment, and then he had it pressed between two pieces of glass to last 500 years. And I went back to California and read the poem to my father, and he paid me, I was probably 38 years old, he paid me the first compliment he'd ever paid me in writing. He looked at me after he read it and he said, I couldn't have written that. So we went up from there.
Wow, first compliment, age 38?
Yeah, I guess.
He had diabetes, and toward the end of his life, he had a series of amputations. Tell me if I'm wrong. I think it was his toes, then his feet, then his legs.
Awful, yeah. And then as a bonus, after those surgeries, he got glaucoma and went blind in about 10 days. So he had a rough time. But during that time, after he went blind, an amazing thing happened. He was in the hospital and incoherent, and we thought he was going to die. And he got a phone call from a screenwriter, a director screenwriter, named Robert Towne. Robert Towne had a film option on Ask the Dust at that time for 20 years.
Let me just say Robert Towne is probably best known for writing the screenplay for Chinatown.
Correct. So Towne, the phone rang in my father's hospital room, and I picked it up, and it was Robert Towne, and I said, Pop, it's Robert Towne. And he immediately became coherent, and for the rest of his life, he was but if it was business, if it was about his work, he was on the money. And then blind, a double amputee, he dictated his last book to my mother word for word while I sat there occasionally and listened. Word for word. Never paused, and he would do a page or two a day. And in 2 months, he'd dictated, and it was brilliant stuff, brilliant stuff.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure, Terry. Thank you for having me on and talking about my stuff and my book and my father's work. It's a great pleasure for me.
Can I just ask you one more thing?
Sure.
It feels like your emotions are very much on the surface, very close to the surface is what I mean. Uh-huh. And that you get in touch with your emotions. And I'm wondering during the period when you were kind of deadening things with alcohol and drugs, were you as given to being emotional then, or did you, were
never.
Were you killing that off?
I I'm sure I didn't cry for 25 years. Mm-hmm. Sure of it. Not, and even death and bad stuff, divorces, jail. I didn't shed a tear for 25 years. No, when there's nothing between me and who I am, when all that peanut butter is gone, you know, it's pretty easy to demonstrate emotion.
Right. Okay, well, thank you again. Good luck with the book, and thanks a lot.
Terry, thank you.
Dan Fonte, author of the novel 86th, speaking to Terry Gross in 2009. Two earlier novels, Mooch and Spitting Off Tall Buildings, have just been republished. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Hot Chip is a British pop music act led by Alexis Taylor and Joe Goddard and a shifting group of backup musicians. Formed in 2000, Hot Chip has had numerous dance club hits, but rock critic Ken Tucker says the group's new album, called One Life Stand, finds Taylor and Goddard mixing their dance music with romantic ballads for an earnest new effectiveness.
My friend once told me something so right. He said to be careful of thieves in the night. Oh, oh, oh. Baby, I've lost you here in the crowd. Open your arms, I want to be found. Oh, oh, oh. Maybe I'm calling.
The core British duo of Hot Chip, Alexis Taylor and Joe Goddard, both sing and play various keyboards, synthesizers, and percussion. Friends since their early teens, the two men share an eclectic taste for disco, house, and techno music, as well as soul and gospel. They also admire some of the more ornate American singer, songwriter, producers from the 60s and 70s, such as Van Dyke Parks and David Ackles. All of these influences converge on a driving ballad such as Hand Me Down Your Love. Chip layers its songs carefully. The beat in any given song is the organizing principle. Every other element is artfully arrayed around it. Listen to the title track of One Life Stand. The song builds from the beat to become a kind of nuanced flirtation, both with the person being flattered in the lyric and you as you get drawn into the allure of the rhythm.
Tell me where you've been to. Nowhere that you shouldn't. Tell me what you're good for. I can tell you something too. Where have you been staying? Tell me what you're playing. Hope it's not my conscience, but it keeps complaining.
I only want to be your one life stand, sings Alexis Taylor there, playing off the phrase one night stand and emphasizing its opposite. This is one dance club denizen who doesn't want a single night of action. He's looking for commitment. When contrasted with music that can be efficient and chilly, such warmth in tone can be a nice surprise. So it goes as well on the song Brothers, a pop hymn to brotherhood, intent on proving it comes from the heart.
Brothers.
I can take it if I know I see my brother. And just step back when I'm dancing with my brother. Is dancing with me. Brothers.
This lack of irony stands in contrast to the history of British synth-pop music. To take just the most famous example, the Pet Shop Boys became a huge success by inserting a languid cynicism into peppy dance tunes. Hot Chip started out making songs that were hits in their native England, trading on just such upbeat, cheeky cleverness. But now that we're older, as they sing on this song called Slush, they assert that it's straightforwardness, honesty, they've called it in interviews, that interests the Hot Chip Boys more frequently.
What is the answer?
No one is ever going to mistake the emotionalism of Hot Chip for the naturalistic realism of Bruce Springsteen or even the ballads of Elton John. But with this album, One Life Stand, Hot Chip earns its ambition and its stylistic shift. Taylor and Goddard are reaching out to a broader audience in a way that's more intimate, more seductive than sexy dance club music can or dares to be.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed One Life Stand from Hot Chip. After working together on the films Ocean's 11, 12, and 13, actor Matt Damon and director Steven Soderbergh reteamed for the 2009 movie The Informant. It's out next week on DVD. The Informant is adapted from a book of investigative journalism about a price-fixing conspiracy involving the agribusiness company ADM. The book also focuses on the ADM executive who blew the whistle and alerted the FBI to the scheme. But the whistleblower had his own secrets, and what he told the FBI wasn't always true. Damon stars as that not-always-reliable whistleblower, Mark Whitaker. Unlike the book, the movie has an ironic, often comic tone. Let's start with a scene. Whitaker has been working undercover with the FBI while continuing his job at ADM. The feds have made their first bust, but none of his colleagues have figured out that Whitaker is the informant. He's intoxicated by playing the role of spy, even though he sometimes unknowingly bungles the job. In this scene, he's with the two FBI agents with whom he's been working, played by Scott Bakula and Joel McHale. They're talking about the bust.
That was amazing. You guys should have seen it. Oh, Terry was so scared, and Mick and the lawyers, they were pissed.
Yeah, that's super, Mark.
And the best part is, they thought you guys gave me the once-over.
Who did you tell? What? Who else did you tell about the raid?
Well, I had to tell my secretary.
Guys, I'm the head of the bioproducts division. She has to know where to get in touch with me. I told her months ago. So all I said was, Liz, I'm doing some work with the FBI. I might be out of touch for a while. That's it. She had no idea about our case. I'm pretty sure I've mentioned the name Kathy Doherty a time or two. She is a trusted ally, and I didn't want her to be scared.
Why did you do that, Mark?
I trust her. Guys, we can trust Kathy.
Who else? Don't jack us around, Mark.
Kirk Schmidt. I mean, Schmitty.
Matt Damon, Steven Soderbergh, welcome back to Fresh Air. The character that you play, Matt Damon, who's based on a real character, Mark Whitaker, who was the whistleblower on ADM and a price-fixing conspiracy, he once he decides to talk to the FBI and wear a wire, part of that process drives him crazy, but part of the process is really seductive to him because, you know, he's seen the movie, he's seen The Firm, he's watched the James Bond films, he kids that he's 0014 because he's twice as good as 007. since you've been in a series of spy films, the Bourne Identity films, what was it like for you to play somebody who wants to be that character and isn't?
It was a lot of fun. It was you know, the opposite of doing the Bourne movies. I think it was always something that I thought was interesting about the character, that he did enjoy. You know, he did see himself as embroiled in the middle of this this drama, and he did constantly refer to Michael Crichton novels, and the character actually became addicted to the movie The Firm and saw himself as Tom Cruise in The Firm, and he would tell his wife he was going one place and he'd go back to the multiplex and sit there and watch The Firm. So there is that aspect of the character that was enjoying the work that he was doing.
Can you talk a little bit about how you stand or walk or move differently as Jason Bourne in a genuine spy thriller and as Mark Whittaker in The Informant, somebody who is an executive at ADM but is wearing a wire and really wants to be the spy kind of thriller person but isn't?
In the case of the Bourne movies, one of the examples I use is that character always stands angled off on whoever he's talking to, because the guy who was teaching me how to handle all these weapons out in the desert in L.A. was a former SWAT shotgunner, and he always stood angled off to me. And I realized it after I'd spent like a couple hundred hours with him, and I said, why are you always standing like that? I mean, is it to present less of an angle or something? He said, well, it's that, but really I just do it out of habit because I wear my gun on this hip and I always keep my body between whoever I'm talking to and my gun. So there, I'm convinced that there are thousands of little things like that are signals. That, you know, when you look at a movie and sometimes you walk out and I'll say to someone, hey, did you like that performance of that, you know, whatever actor? And a lot of times somebody will say, yeah, no, I didn't, not really. And I'd say, well, why? And they can't quite put their finger on it, but I'm convinced that there are hundreds of little details and little signals that you're sending to somebody who's watching the performance that add up to make a performance believable or not.
What kind of conversations do you have with each other when you're making a film? Like Steven Soderbergh, do you give a lot of directions to the actors? Do you have conversations about motivation and that kind of stuff?
Boy, you know, I try not to.
Why not? Honestly,
I don't want anybody. I don't want an actor. It sounds terrible. I don't want them thinking. I want them just behaving the way the character would.
And Matt Damon said he kind of geeks out on the details.
You're preparing so that when you're in the moment, you're responding as the character would respond. But it's been my experience that when you can give an actor practical things to do, physical things to do, that really helps them lock in to the character. And I really don't like to engage in philosophical conversations while we're shooting, because I feel like it puts them in their head, and I don't want them in their head.
That's exactly right. I mean, from an actor's perspective too, that's exactly right. And the things that I geek out over, it's just when I'm thinking about it, it's a totally different stage of the of the whole deal. When it's happening, you need practical. You know, in fact, I'm working with the first time director right now, and I jokingly told him that he was on a shot clock. If he can't say it in 15 seconds, I just start hearing white noise. Because now, if you want to have philosophical conversations, that's great, and I'll go out to dinner with you in pre-production, and we can talk for hours and hours and hours. And sometimes that's really helpful and good, and talk about thematically what's happening, and you know, all that's great. But when shooting a movie is a very different kind of stage of the process. And to talk about Steven's direction for a second, I would say, it's how I feel about a bunch of the directors I've worked with, who all work very differently. But like with Gus Van Sant or Clint Eastwood or Francis, like their direction is always necessary and helpful. So they don't give me any more direction than I need. But like an example would be in this movie, there's a scene where I apologize, and I'm in court, and I apologize to the community, and I apologize to all of these people right before I'm sentenced. And on the first take, I did it as I thought he would have done it. It was this very heartfelt apology. And Steven said cut, and he came over, and he just sat down next to me, and he went, no. And I said, what do you mean? I thought that was really I was honest that I felt something there that felt pretty real. And he goes, oh, no, it was good. He said, it's just in the wrong movie. The tone of this movie was so specific that all the actors were really relying on Steven to kind of have the view from 30,000 feet at all times, because we can get lost in a moment or in a scene and go off the rails pretty quickly, and that's what had happened to me. And so I said, okay, well, all right, what do I do? And he thought it for a second, and then he said, do it like an awards acceptance speech. and that was it, and that was my direction, and it's brilliant direction, and it's why I love working with him, and why I've gone back to work with Gus and Francis, and I'm going to go back and work with Clint again. I have such trust in somebody who can give me a perfect piece of direction that doesn't bog me down, that doesn't take me out of it, but just basically is utterly helpful.
Stephen, what made you think of an awards acceptance speech as being like the right tone?
I guess it's because I knew that part of him, that he liked that kind of attention. And so I wanted to have a sense of that, of the pleasure of that. And it contributes to the fact that he's often disconnected from the context in which he's operating. You're always trying to find the right metaphor to give somebody an idea. And for some reason, I thought of him standing up there sort of with an Oscar in his hand. And what would that sound like?
If you're just joining us, my guests are Steven Soderbergh and Matt Damon. They work together on the Oceans movie, starting with Ocean's 11. And now they've worked together on The Informant. Steven Soderbergh directed it. Matt Damon stars in it as a whistleblower at ADM, and it's adapted from the true story as reported in Kurt Eichenwald's book, The Informant. Let me take you on a tangent for a second, Matt Damon. You did one of the really funny videos. This is really one of the funnier moments of recent TV history, I think. It was a video that Sarah Silverman made for the Jimmy Kimmel Show. And at the time this was on, they were a couple. I don't know if they still are. Anyway, so she comes on his show and says, I have something very, very important to tell you. And then it cuts to this video. And the video is her saying, I am blanking Matt Damon. I can't say the word, but you'll get what it is. It's a word I can't say on the radio. I'm blanking Matt Damon. And then it cuts to you, and you're there looking very, very handsome on the couch. And you say, yes, she is blanking Matt Damon. And then it goes into this whole kind of song and dance video thing. And, there's like parodies of like hip-hop dance videos and, like love scenes from videos. How did Matt Damon become the person who she wanted to brag to her boyfriend Jimmy Kimmel that she was blanking?
Well, it started, there's been a kind of a running joke with Jimmy and me, and I don't know how he picked me. He told me that he does this thing at the end of his show where he says, my apologies to Matt Damon, we ran out of time. And it's this running joke that I'm sitting waiting to come on, but I was basically bumped by whatever guests he has on the show that night.
Which is something that typically happens to up-and-coming people or the writer
who's
on the end of the show, or the unknown comic. Yeah.
Exactly. And they end up doing an extra segment with one of the people, one of their headliners, and that guy gets bumped. And so it started because he had such a depressing show one night. He said, I had like a ventriloquist and a guy in a gorilla suit. And, it was one of those shows where I had this feeling like nobody was watching. And just as a kind of a throwaway at the end of his, when he was saying goodnight, everybody, he said, my apologies to Matt Damon. We ran out of time. And his producer, who was standing by on the other side of the camera, just doubled over laughing. And so he just started doing it every night because the two of those guys thought it was really funny. So Sarah called with this idea of the show was originally going to air on his what was going to be his 40th birthday party, but the writer's strike happened and it ended up being done at a different time. But basically, I can take absolutely no credit for that video. It was a great idea that they had. Sarah showed up in Miami. We shot it in like 2 hours because I had to go to a parent-teacher conference. And I wasn't expecting it to have even that much production value. I got there at 7 in the morning and they had, red jumpsuits and backup dancers. And I was like, oh, okay, this is funny. So It was basically just I was the beneficiary of some very funny people doing some really good writing.
Good luck with the new movie and everything else. And I really want to thank you both so much for talking with us. Matt Damon, Steven Soderbergh, thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
Actor Matt Damon and director Steven Soderbergh speaking with Terry Gross last year. Their latest collaboration, The Informant, comes out next week on DVD. Two mystery thrillers with increasingly paranoid heroes open this week, and each is directed by a filmmaking legend, Martin Scorsese and Roman Polanski. Scorsese's Shutter Island, set in 1954, stars Leonardo DiCaprio and a cast that includes Ben Kingsley, Michelle Williams, and Max von Sydow. Polanski's The Ghostwriter, a much more contemporary story, stars Ewan McGregor and Pierce Brosnan. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
The two new movies by Martin Scorsese and Roman Polanski make for a study in contrasts, an incredibly depressing one. That's because Scorsese's film is dead on the screen, while Polanski's simmers with a passion for storytelling. And guess which director is unlikely to make another movie? Scorsese's Shutter Island is closely based on Dennis Lehane's novel about a Boston detective, played on screen by Leonardo DiCaprio, who travels to an island hospital for the criminally insane to investigate the disappearance of a female patient. The novel is a slight but engrossing doodle about illusion or delusion versus reality, a bit like Paul Auster, but more Freudian. For Lehane, it was a breather between Mystic River and his panoramic Any Given Day, but Scorsese draws it out to 2 hours and 19 minutes of tracking shots and bombastic music and shrieking storms and detectives in long coats and fedoras trudging past leering mental patients. Without giving anything away, it's fair to say what seem like over-the-top tropes from 40s and 50s noir are meant to evoke old movies, to seem artificial. But even when the Hollywood detective story foundation begins to crumble and the gumshoe protagonist is racked with visions of concentration camps and bloody children and Nazi experiments, Shutter Island is still suffocatingly movie-ish. Many filmmakers, when they hit their 60s, pare down their styles and strive to be simpler and more direct. But Scorsese has become more impersonal, more like the big-budget studio director he so palpably wasn't when he helped transform American cinema. Here, he visually invokes a score of movies, from The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari to Laura to Frederick Wiseman's graphic asylum documentary Titicut Follies, and there isn't an image that feels organic. Despite a lot of heavy emotional lifting by DiCaprio and fun turns by Mark Ruffalo and Ben Kingsley as an oddly paternal head psychiatrist, it's all like window displays in a movie museum. Or a movie morgue. Polanski, whatever his off-screen travails both as victim and victimizer, is all there in The Ghostwriter, an audaciously timely, paranoid political conspiracy mystery. Ewan McGregor plays a writer for hire who's drafted at the last minute, his predecessor mysteriously drowned, to rework the much-anticipated memoirs of an ex-prime minister named Lang, obviously Tony Blair, and played by Pierce Brosnan. Lang is reviled by his countrymen for hitching his country to the U.S. invasion of Iraq, and he's now under investigation by an international human rights tribunal for turning over suspects to the CIA for torture. The media descends on his U.S. refuge on an estate in an empty, wintry Martha's Vineyard, where the PM and his severe wife, played by Olivia Williams, and perky aide, played by Kim Cattrall, consider the most prudent course of action.
If it suits them, they will hang you out to dry. You need a lawyer. Call Sid.
Get Sid on the line.
What about the media? Issue a holding statement, something short.
Oh, this is what we need, Mike.
I'll write something. Let him do it. He's supposed to be the writer.
Well, hang on a minute.
I should say I'm confident. Not defensive. That'd be fatal. But I shouldn't be cocky. No bitterness, no anger. And don't say I'm pleased at this opportunity to clear my name or any balls like that.
So you're not defensive, but you're not cocky. You're not angry, but you're not pleased.
That's it.
Then what exactly are you?
Told you it was funny.
The title character is funny, and Ewan McGregor has never been better. He's cheeky, yet also watchful, increasingly edgy, and his eyes are as alive as Polanski's camera. The movie, based on a novel by Robert Harris, is perfect Polanski material. The loner hero is spiritually isolated, trapped in vast spaces, on dunes and rain-swept beaches, under low, threatening skies, and unable to move without being watched. There's an undercurrent of lust, too, a ghoulish attraction between McGregor and the seething, joyless Olivia Williams. The Ghostwriter is not especially realistic in its depiction of anti-war protesters descending on the British PM everywhere in the U.S. Such protests didn't come near to major politicians, even in the war's heyday. But Polanski's touch is so sure that the film is entrancing to the last tumultuous frame. There's more than a touch of Hitchcock, but Polanski makes the fluid, paranoid style his own, inorganic expressionism that dwarfs Scorsese's third-rate horrors in Shutter Island.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.